I'm Elizabeth Vincentelli. I write for The New York Times, The New Yorker, and The Village Voice.
I'm Peter Marks, theater critic of The Washington Post.
And I'm Terry Teachout, drama critic of The Wall Street Journal. Welcome to the 16th episode of Three on the Isle, a podcast from New York about theater in America. We're hosted by American Theater Magazine, a publication of the Theater Communications Group. Peter and Elizabeth are speaking to you from our studio in New York. I'm Skyping in from a farmhouse in Connecticut, where some remodeling is going on as we speak. So if you hear any funny noises in the background, just pretend the sound designer had one too many this morning.
Are you punching through the roof with your own atrium, Terry? Is that what you're doing?
Yes, absolutely. That's right.
I've heard you're a marvel at this kind of stuff. I've heard your TV is really waiting for you.
I have one skill. I'm a good picture hanger. Beyond that, nothing.
Oh, that's impressive. Very few people can do that.
Oh, I've got that. I've got that down pat.
Right. Okay. Cool.
All right. So today is going to be a very special day because we are going to take questions from listeners, questions that have been left on the brand new Three on the Isle voicemail. I think we're just preparing for the inevitable day when we're going to do this live in front of an audience. So we're working on our mad, you know, skills, answering skills here.
Are we going to do one in a swimming pool too? Wasn't that the plan?
Yeah, that's the plan.
You know, like a water kind of, thing. Anyway,
It's our little stage that I think everybody will be most impressed with.
Oh yes,
right. Really?
We're also going to address a feedback that was sent the old-fashioned way, which in 2018 means by email.
And we encourage everybody listening, if you want to be in touch with us, use any channel you can think of. Just let us hear from you, and we'll get back to you.
Except no physical contact, please.
Yeah, that's right.
We're going to start, before we get to the questions, we're going to start with some sad news that came down the pike earlier this week. The New York Daily News has slashed its staff, which was already very small after previous rounds of slashing. I think they were down to like 90 people, and now they're down half that, which is
40,
crazy,
45, I think. Yeah.
Crazy. Yeah. And unfortunately, that round of layoffs, including our wonderful colleague
Joe Dominowitz,
who I've been there. That happened to me when I was in New York Post 2 years
17
ago.
17 years.
Right. It's really distressing because, well, on a personal level, because Joe is very loved and respected, you know, in our little community.
Right.
But I think what's distressing is the message it sends.
Well, Joe was also their general arts writer. He sort of like had segued from theater criticism solely to becoming an arts writer to try to salvage, I assume, his job. And of course, that followed by just a couple of weeks, the elimination of Chris Vier's job at Time Out Chicago, which leaves Chicago with, you know, I think one major critic, Chris Jones, we've had on the show. And I will just say that beyond distressing, it's infuriating because I've come to the conclusion, though, that we have a day of tributes to Joe, who's known as Joe D on Twitter. You know, let me just say it. Nobody cares. Nobody cares anymore. You know, we're out here doing this until someone tells us to stop doing it. I just don't know that anyone gives a shit.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the blunt truth.
Yeah. I think we all have to recognize, if not to accept, that Joe's dismissal is a portrait, a snapshot of what is to come, not just in arts coverage, but for regional newspapers in general, as their local reports contract. We're not going to have new newspaper jobs added in arts coverage. Every once in a while, you do hear about somebody landing a new job, but it's not the direction that it's going in. The future of arts coverage, including theater reviewing, will be elsewhere. Where that is, we're going to find out.
I would just say that over you know, the decade and a half plus that Joe was writing about the arts and theater in particular, you know, God knows how many tickets he sold for these producers and got people to go to shows all over New York and beyond. We've all done this, And I would just say, where is the theater world to step up and try and help us solve this problem? There is no, absolutely no help.
You know,
and I just would say, I'm fed up. I'm fed up with people, you know, lamenting this and nobody helping us try to come to some kind of understanding. We fall back on the idea that it's, you know, a Darwinian world out there, which is absolutely true. Nobody is guaranteed a job. You know, you'll get a day's wages for a day's work until there isn't the work. But damn it, Broadway makes a flipping fortune, and I have heard nothing from the theater world I don't care how conflicted they are about criticism. And frankly, shame on the theater world for the way it handles this.
I think people do not understand what a world without criticism will be like. Some people think, oh, great, that bastard who wrote the bad review about me, you know, he's gotten the shaft. But I may have quoted it on a podcast before, but it's always worth hearing again. Virgil Thompson, the great classical music critic of the New York Herald Tribune, said, one must never forget that the only alternative to criticism is paid publicity. And if you think that you're going to enjoy a world without criticism, well, now you're going to find out in many cities what that's like.
Oh, I think it's already there. We're already there in many cities. New York was a holdout, less so. And I agree with Peter. The theater world, if by theater world we mean the people who get stuff done on Broadway, all Broadway cares about, or at least the Broadway League, is like every whenever May is trumpeting that they had the best season ever. Thanks mostly to outrageous prices. Yeah, you can make like $4 billion in a season.
Listen.
But, I mean, that's almost easy when you're charged $700 a ticket.
You think anybody's getting rich as a theater critic? I'm not complaining. I love the job. Listen, I am not saying that this job doesn't come with wonderful access and perks. There is just no doubt about it. I wouldn't do it if I didn't feel that way. But the people in this business make way more than we do. And it's not just a matter of economics, but it is at some level an economic question. And the theater world better step up, because this is not a growing field. This is a contracting field, and we're a symptom of that. You know, it's not the whole story, but it's part of the story. And I am fucking pissed off about it.
I just wonder what they're going to put on their big shiny billboards on Times Square for their shows. You know, where like they have those quotes, and it's right. What is it going to be now? It's going to be. I can't even imagine.
Right.
They're going to have to make shit up, which of course they already do.
But. Yeah. I went up to the O'Neill Theater Center last week to talk to a group of critics who are we're in the Critics Institute that Chris Jones of the Tribune is the head of. It's a wonderful program, about 20 incredibly talented, smart, devoted arts writers of all shapes and sizes and ages. And, you know, I'm talking about a field I believe in, but I don't know, you know, and I'm amazed they find niches for themselves, but where is this going? Somebody help me understand. Somebody, I want to hear voices, you know, I want to hear about this.
Well, I think we're absolutely right to curse the darkness. I couldn't agree more. But at the same time, they're going to have to not find niches, but make them.
Right,
The three of us are sitting, well, not in a room, we're sitting in two rooms, talking into microphones.
Right.
Using a channel of communication that really didn't exist, hadn't even been imagined years ago. And I think the younger people that we all meet, the millennials who are as passionate about theater as we are, but who did not grow up in a world where they could expect to write for newspapers, are saying, if they care about it enough, okay, what do we do instead? How do we reach out instead of using this medium that is no longer interested in us? They will come up with the solutions. I mean, it's amazing to me that here we are, three old geezers, and we're doing a podcast. I mean, that's hooray for us. But really, the solutions will come from not just the next generation, but the generation after the next generation. And they better get cracking. They better look at what happened to Joe and say, okay, that means we now know even more than we knew yesterday. We know that the world that maybe when we were young we thought we could get into doesn't exist anymore. Now what do we do?
Right. Well, I would just say, if you want to, you know, wrap this up, I would just say, Joe and Chris, we love your work. We love your devotion to this craft, and we want to see you online and in print again.
We wish you both the very best. And now we're going to invite our listeners into the conversation, talking about new technologies. We're going to start with a couple of emails that we've received directly at Three on the Isle. One was from HKMart3, who wrote about our episode about whitewashing. Here's a summary of his message. My observation was that Mr. Teachout found the disruption and incivility at the Muni Opera unproductive. It reminded me of an article in the New York Times about disruption as a necessary and positive influence. I would normally share Mr. Teachout's preference for a different demeanor in our public discourse, particularly within the institutions that I hold dear, like theater. But I am also a middle-aged white man, and I suspect the deep trans-spirited defense of a more aggressive level of engagement is more in keeping with the tradition of effective disruptions and coercions in the past. That's aimed partly at me, and it's very much food for thought, but I also want to add something. I've heard myself on the aisle from a whole lot of people who heard that last podcast, and I really want to assure all of you, Deep and I are very good friends. We really are. We go to the theater together. And at the end of taping that segment, no, we weren't trying to choke each other on the floor of the studio. You know, we laughed. I believe she said, "We're still friends, aren't we?" And I said, "Oh, God, yes, Deep, forever." Because intense, passionate disagreement. That, too, is a part of what this is all about.
Right, right.
Yeah,
the
right.
The act of criticism, the act of thoughtful commentary. And up to a point, Lord Copper, the hotter, the better. And it was really hot last time, and I loved every second of it. I think Deep did, too. And I hope you all understand that we were serious, but we were serious as friends.
Well, I think it's one of the things we've been trying to do on this podcast is to be able to be in a room or via Skype and have completely different opinions, but still be able to talk to each other. And I'm really afraid that this is something that's disappearing in our current climate, where people are just shut down without any possibility of exchange. And it's I find it disheartening. And that's something we are trying to do, as we did when we had that conversation about what happened at Muni, when to remind listeners, there was a protest about a production of Jerome Robbins. And actually, we got another email about that very subject and what happened. And so we got a quite lengthy and eloquent email from Carlos Valladares, who's a critic primarily of film and jazz and does a bit of theater as well. And it's a long email, so I'm going to try to summarize it. So I'm quoting him right there. As a Latino and a critic of color, I sympathize very much with what Deep Trent was explaining in terms of feeling utterly horrified at seeing such blatant whitewashing. On the other hand, I am also aware that while the majority of films that I love, classic Hollywood, were overwhelmingly made by whites, I find myself appreciating the films on their own terms for what they achieve stylistically and formally. What does get lost in a discussion of whitewashing is the celebratory atmosphere of the project, a celebration of Jerome Robbins' incredible contribution to Broadway and film. Ironically, the film that got me into Robbins was the 1961 Robert Wise production of West Side Story, one of the more talked about instances of whitewashing in Hollywood. There's a lot of negatives to be said about the film in that regard, but a lot of why I love the film has everything to do with Robbins' choreography, the dynamic movement of his ballets and showdowns. Now, I am glad today production of West Side Stories use Latinx actors. Maybe the problems are slightly different for film because they are static, quote-unquote, static performances trapped in a specific period of time versus the elasticity of the stage performance where you can, today, cast an Asian actor in The King and I. Even so, I do get angry whenever people dismiss a whitewashed film, especially one that happens to be a masterpiece, as quote-unquote, being of its time, as if it didn't have other worthwhile things to say and incredible moments of direction, performance, and philosophical inquiry. Now, I am very much, I would say globally, I'm pretty much in agreement with that take. I find it in many cases,
pointless
to go after a movie from the 30s for and attacking it on grounds that were completely different in the 30s. And I'm not excusing the 30s attitude.
Well, that's it. I mean, we don't have to have a binary attitude about these things. We can hold two ideas in our heads at one time. The problem that's happening with the breakdown on social media is that, you know, it's all when it boils down to these, you know, declarations, these sort of like blanket statements, we lose all the sense of nuance. And yes, of course, you can love something that's deeply flawed and of its time is not necessarily a condemnation. I think it really comes to we're all struggling for a consensus on this. And on the way to it, there are lots of bumps in the road. That wonderful exchange between Deep and Terry is an indicator of that. It's illustrative of how hard this is, how we're all wrestling with this. I think it would be nicer, and maybe this will happen, is if we all took a breath sometimes and realized that someone coming at this from another angle is not necessarily a threat. That if people from different points of view who want their say, who feel like their voices haven't yet been completely included, aren't seen as replacing necessarily, supplanting what we think of as the sort of establishment or this white privilege or whatever, the more we inculcate that and start to understand it and make room for it, I think these issues will resolve themselves and you won't have to have disruptions. But I think it takes time, and we're a big, multifaceted country with a really screwed up political environment right now. It makes it very volatile.
I think that if you want civil discourse, and some people quite explicitly do not want it, they don't believe in it, but if you believe in civil discourse, the starting point, it seems to me, is to assume the goodwill of the other, rather than assuming that the other, the person you're talking to, is not a person of goodwill. When you treat the other with respect, the same respect that you expect them to treat you with, then you get a very different kind of discourse. The trouble with Twitter is that it's very often, it appears to be a one-way channel in which people start not at 2, but at 20, and come in yelling. And it can be stimulating, sometimes it can be exciting, but I think ultimately it's poisonous. There are other ways even to use Twitter, which I find can be a completely civil and stimulating and exciting place to have discourse. But you've got to start with the assumption that the person you're talking to is serious and of goodwill. And if they give you really good reason not to think so, that's different. But until they do, you should at least operate on that assumption. That's how I feel anyway.
Well, that's a great way to end this segment, or at least this part of our feedback section, because we are the most interactive critics in theater land. We've become we are so of the moment. No one should ever let us go, because we are constantly looking for ways to reach out to the world beyond us. So, in the interest of that, we are going to now go to the first voicemail recording reactions we've ever done on Three on the Isle. This is our 16th episode?
Yeah, 16th.
Woo. Yes.
Anyway, and our incredibly talented producer, Kirby Pate, has teed up the questions that you all phoned in. So how are we going to do this, Kirby? We're going to just play the first question? Okay. First, we have a question from Amanda about the name of our show.
Hello, my name is Amanda. I'm calling from Arlington, Virginia. First off, I wanted to let you all know how much I enjoy your podcast, and I want to continue to encourage you all to continue these fantastic episodes. My question for you all is actually somewhat related to the title of your podcast. I've worked at many DC-based theaters with a variety of opinions about where you all prefer to sit during performances, and I'm sure that all depends on the theater layout, but typically where do you all prefer to sit during press-related performances or opening nights, etc.? And specifically, why do you like those seats? Is it safe to say that you all like the aisles, or do you like to sit near other members of the press? Do you like to sit just with sort of the general public? Do you like to sit with VIPs, donors, etc. I definitely would appreciate your insight on that because I always want to make sure that you all have the best seats and enjoy our shows. Thanks so much.
That's a great question.
I, for one, want Flying by Foy to suspend me over the audience. You know, I don't care. I really don't care. There are disadvantages to sitting on the aisle, which is that people always clamber over you. On the other hand, if I'm with a short person, as my what we call a plus one, I can let the plus one sit on the aisle. Honestly, I'm really not fussy about where I sit. I've never been fussy about it. And the aisle, of course, is a convention. I don't think our listeners necessarily know that. 30, 40 years ago, newspaper reviewers, at which time there were many of them, had to file reviews late at night in order to make the morning editions. And so they would sit on the aisle because very often they would have to leave the performance before it was over. So they'd go running up the aisle, and they're on the aisle so they don't have to clamber over people. And then they'd head for grab a cab for the newspaper office and write the piece. The convention has survived even though the need for it has not. So I don't know about you two, but you can put me pretty much anywhere you want and I'll be happy.
I do like the aisle because for purely practical reason, it's when I take my notes, there's usually a little bit more light by the aisle. And I can kind of like lean over and write on my knee or something. And I only bother like, you know, like it's much easier. I can kind of lean down and like for a second, like if I need to look at something. But that's it. There are a couple of venues in New York where I actually, there's some seats. And the only time I ask for a particular seat, actually, there's that one venue. It's when I go to Encores at City Center. I know that some of the press seats are in the front row of the mezzanine. And I ask if that's possible. I don't want to. It's not a diva demand, but if those are available, I like being in the front row of the mezzanine because it is a fantastic view, especially when there's dancing. And I love seeing the orchestra, which is on stage at Encores. So that's my favorite. But otherwise, I'm fine.
It's such a great question because we spend so much time on our asses, and it really helps, you know, when it's, frankly, it is our office. And it is nice when we're thought of. I can't deny that that's really nice. My favorite spot to sit in a two-aisle theater with a middle section is on the right or on the left on the aisle. Like, you know, so like this is usually something like GH or K2 and 4. Amanda, if you're looking for numbers. I just like that perspective. It's harder for me to look over an audience. It, from the middle section, believe it or not, if you're on the aisle, sometimes that's not the best place to watch from, I have found, because also I'm distracted sometimes by the heads moving around and people reacting. I do like to look at other people, but I like to make the choice myself to gaze on the other audience members. And I find that those seats on the side are kind of the prime purchase for me to do that. I also would love at some point, and I don't know how you guys feel about this, I would love if someone would put me in the back row or in the second balcony of a show that is, I don't know, either visually interesting or acoustically challenging, because I would love to experience the seating that real people sit in. Very few people get to sit in the seats we get to sit in.
Actually, that happened.
Well, that would be a great feature.
That happened to me at Harry Potter, because for the first one, so Harry Potter and the Cursed Child on Broadway is in two different parts. And for the first one, they had put me way in the back. I went on the aisle, but I was very much in the back. So I had a really good view of the kind of like general overall feeling of the stagecraft. And for the second one, I was much closer, like maybe like EF, which for this show is like close up. And I much prefer being in the back.
The other thing people should know, Terry and Elizabeth, you were both bringing up, is that we get a pair of tickets to most things comped, meaning for free. And that is as much, and I think we've discussed this before, but that is as much for the convenience of the theater as it is for us. They want us to come, and they know that our organizations probably would not fork over big bucks for every show that we we go to. And I guess that's the point at which I should just slightly change. That is a way in which the theater has always been helpful to us in terms of.
And also, I think we need to make clear that we never go to opening nights. So the issue of sitting with the donors or the VIPs
in Washington,
does not
come
up. Oh, you do in Washington?
Yeah, in Washington, the press night and the opening night is the same.
Okay.
So
most regional theaters work that way.
And it's always, I would say, Amanda, that, you know, seat me as far away from the donors as possible because usually they don't, and they all have name tags, and they turn around and look and smile at me at intermission, and I would prefer not to have to frown back at them if I'm not having a good time. But anyway, that said,
yes,
we could talk about this subject all afternoon or night. But let's go on to – should we go on to the next one?
Yes, let's do that.
We have a question from Chip about seats in a Broadway theater.
Hi, this is Chip. Fantastic show. Love it. Here's the question. There are theater renovations happening on Broadway, the Helen Hayes being one example. They're finally paying more attention to amenities like bathrooms, but still do absolutely nothing about the seating, which is pretty painful at some of the older theaters. Is this ever going to change? Thanks a lot.
No, never. Damn them. The seats on Broadway, I've been keeping a checklist of who has the worst seats on Broadway. And unfortunately,
it's a
everybody
tie
does.
Between
everybody.
Everybody.
Yeah.
And I often bring with me people who have physical issues, and those seats are really uncomfortable. They're uncomfortable for everybody. I'm a big guy. They're uncomfortable for me. They're inadequately padded. Nobody has thought about the question of what a theater seat ought to be like to ensure comfort for the viewer. As far as I know, nobody's thinking about it. And I wish to hell they would.
I pretty much agree. I mean, I was surprised actually at the Helen Hayes, which was completely refurbished. So they had a golden opportunity to start from scratch. And those seats are just murder. They're very, very tight. The Helen Hayes is just, that's a shocker.
Well, you know, there's a theory about this. I think it was Guthrie. I think it might have been Tyrone Guthrie who had very strong feelings about how closely people should be together in a theater. I mean, he actually wanted you to be not so much uncomfortable, but very aware of the people around you. That may have sort of like bled down through the years into other kinds of theater design and the thoughts about how much comfort you should give people in a theater. And we may be a little more sensitive to this than other people. But I would say that the big problem is, I would say, leg room. I mean, that's, you know, I don't care how much, you know, my fat ass has, you know, is getting pleasure through, you know, during that's the wrong image. Please cut that, Kirby.
Oh, no, Lou, keep it in.
I'm saying, in other words, in my knees, it's my knees. And as you get older, that's the joints.
I actually am convinced that it's a ploy to make sure that we're staying awake. And because there's absolutely no sleeping in those seats.
You know, Charles Laughton actually said something about this. He was trying to get Lillian Gish to do The Night of the Hunter with him, the movie that he directed. And he said that he would sit in movie houses and he would look at the people and they were slouched back in their seats eating their popcorn. He said he wanted to make a movie where, like they did in the old days of silent films, they were all sitting forward on the edge of their seats.
Right.
And it does kind of remind me, if the show is good,
right,
the seat doesn't matter.
Exactly.
Yes, that is so true.
Bravo. John has a question about the role of politics in criticism.
My name is John Meyer. I'm with the theater company Thinkery and Verse. And I wonder, all three of your critics are engaged in other types of criticism besides just theater or thinking about other types of art and politics. And I wonder, to what extent have your newspaper editors been open to theater reviews going far beyond the scope of just a theater review, what you see on the stage, and allowing you to bounce your ideas off of politics and political space or what's in the current news? Thank you.
Terry, what do you
think
about
that? That's
a great
question.
Yeah, Terry, should we put our own politics into our reviews?
I try not to, but what I try to do is if a show is itself specifically political, if it's trying to get you to think something or to do something – then its content becomes irrelevant. If a show makes a truth claim, and the truth claim is something I know to be false, then it's my job to point that out. But I'd like to come around at this from another direction. I was hired by the Wall Street Journal because we discussed it, and they said to me, we're looking for somebody who knows about more than just theater.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who's interested in all of the arts, who's written about all of the arts, and who can relate theater to the larger world of art and culture. That's my remit.
Mm.
It includes politics. And they want that out of me. And it's what I want to do. I don't especially want to write reviews in which I bang the gavel on the block about politics, because a lot of people do that.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe I have other things to offer as a critic. You don't often necessarily review shows where the political aspect is salient, although I'm about to do that in the next couple of days. I'll be writing about straight white men, and in a different way, the Go-Go's musical. They both have real political content. But I wouldn't ever want the whole review to be about that. And even now, even after the horrible To Gringolade that we were talking about at the top of the podcast, there are still a lot of voices, and there are a lot of people doing the things that they like to do and want to do and do best. And this is what I want to do. I want to be an aesthete who is aware of criticism who is aware of theater as a part of the larger world of art and culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to try to connect the dots. That's how I see my mission. And my editors are all for that. That's the real answer to the question.
I think we necessarily are political in the way we look at something, because we write as who we are. And we are, the writing is informed by our opinions, our thoughts, our backgrounds. And even if you don't think you're writing about a political play, it's going to come out in one way or another. Like the worldview of the critic is in everything he or she sees. And how we write about it is necessarily informed by that. So the Go-Go's, their musical, is a great example, because you would think, like a fluffy Go-Go's musical, but the way you're going to look at that show is really very much influenced by how you think politically. I don't see how it could not be. And so aesthetics are really very much informed by how you think politically, I think.
I think you have to separate political writing from partisanship.
I think
that's sort of the line. You can't not have your work somehow reflect some sense of your political values. There's just no other way to write. I asked, in fact, a couple of weeks ago, I was at Aspen, at the Aspen Ideas Festival, name dropping, and I was moderating a panel called The Impact of Theater on the National Conversation. And one of the panelists, in between seeing scenes from some interesting plays through the last century, one of the panelists was David Brooks, who's a very literate, thoughtful man on the rightward tilt of the political spectrum. And I asked him on stage, I said, do you think theater misses the boat with something like 40 to 50% of the population by being so geared towards progressive voices? And he said, I was surprised at his answer, which was, no, I think actually, people go to the theater, understand that you're going to, even people who are more conservative than the people who may be writing and performing in the theater, they understand that those are the things they're going to be exposed to. And I think for the most part, they can tolerate those. And I think that that's probably true as long as it's not too strident or too agitprop. I'm now talking as myself. But I think that the question of how much you inject politics really goes to a more personal question of how much politics guides you in your daily life and how much you bring into the theater with you, how much you see of that in what you're experiencing. And frankly, this year, I see way more of what I'm feeling politically on the stage than I did in years before, because, mm-hmm. The theater is about resistance to some degree, and we feel that. You feel that bleeding through in a lot of, from anything from Shakespeare to, new Pulitzer Prize winning plays. So it's not that we're going to be op-ed columnists. That's not what we do. But you will feel who we are and what we think about social issues. It's, you know, if you read us closely.
Yeah. The great thing about theater is that it brings past and present together in the present moment, in our space, on the stage, and thus provides a unique opportunity, if you wish to use it that way, to comment on the present moment. But it doesn't have to.
Right.
It can do whatever you want. And if you wish simply to write a delicious champagne-like farce that does nothing other than take us out of the moment, well, maybe that's a political statement, too. Maybe it says that we need to be taken out of the moment. We as critics are the ones who have to decide what needs to be mentioned, what is salient. And for me, at least, I don't want to hear the same thing every night.
Right.
I want to be entertained. But I am quite capable of being entertained both by stage blood and, under certain circumstances, by politics.
Do you think as a woman, Elizabeth, you get more a blowback from people who, from men who don't want you to have strong opinions about politics?
I haven't noticed that, actually. No, I haven't noticed that just in terms of like a gendered response to, you know, I haven't noticed that you get blowback.
Just generally.
Just generally. I think it's part
of
the game.
Yeah, and especially at the Times.
Yeah, and especially if you're on at the Times and on Twitter.
Right.
It's going to happen. So, but I've got to say overall, no.
I just wonder if there's more bullying that goes on. From Virginia, a question about how one gets a one-act play produced.
Hi. Excuse me. My name is Virginia Mastriani. I, like a million people or more, have written a one-act play, and I have no idea how to shop it around. And I'm curious as to what your opinion is, or if this is an inane question, I apologize. But I want to take the correct steps, and I'd love to hear your thoughts. Thank you so much. Your show is great. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So how do you break – do critics have that capacity to help people find their stage?
I think we come in later. I mean, I've got to say I don't really know how to answer that. I don't really have that experience, so I don't think I would be, yeah.
Well,
I actually do.
Go ahead.
And I may be able to provide a bit of useful advice here. Unfortunately, we don't know enough, Virginia, about your own experience to be specific in the answer. The first thing to do, if you haven't done this yet, is to get a bunch of people together in your living room and do a reading of this show. If you are not at all a part of the world of theater, it's going to be a little tricky to come in from nowhere and do this. But if you have any connections to theater, you should be starting by putting together a reading. There are playwriting competitions. They're not hard to find out about. They're all on the web. There is no easy route to production. It is just as hard as hell. But it is possible. But you've got to find out a lot of things. And if you wish to send an email to us supplying more information about your own personal experience, I will be glad to reply to it directly, because maybe I can be of help to you, not as a critic, but as somebody who's been involved in the other end of production and might have some useful suggestions to make.
I think there's also, you know, I think there's strength in numbers. And if you find people, and, you know, there are plenty of ways online to find, you know, writers who are, you know, trying to get produced. But, you know, years ago, there was an organization called 13P, which was a collective of 13, I think, playwrights. Am I wrong?
That sounds
13P.
Right.
13P. Yeah, it's disbanded.
I think Annie Baker was part of it, and I think Brandon Jacobs Jenkins. I mean, I think there were some major playwrights, each of whom committed through this collective to getting one of their plays produced. This is one of the new models that's happening. And it's not, you know, it takes a lot of work, but if you can find people who can actually help you hone your play, like a book club instead of a playwriting club. I don't even know how to describe
this. Yeah, I think the collective approach seems to be a model that's quite...
It might be a very useful way to get your, you know, to hear your play and people to support you. And you'll find out if it's producible, mm-hmm. you know, very quickly just from hearing those people.
The wider answer to this, though, is this word comes up a lot on this podcast. Theater is a community. if you are not a part of the community, get that way. And then suddenly you're going to find out very quickly what the next move could be. But is there? Are you in a city that has a theater, a community theater? Have you any ties to a local professional regional theater? Start reaching out. And as I say, Virginia, please feel free to drop us an email. And I have no magic wand, but I might be able to tell you a few things.
Well, guys, that was I think pretty good. I'm pretty happy with the questions. They were all solid questions. But now it's time for us to give our recommendations about something we've seen lately. And I'm going to start us off by talking about briefly a wonderful production of Coriolanus that I saw at the Stratford Shakespeare Festival in Ontario. It's Robert Lepage's production, a highly cinematic piece of theater that, if you know Lepage's work, is tremendously visual. He's an imagist of incredible range. And this was one of the most stunning depictions of this piece, this difficult piece, that I've ever seen. Reworked a bit, but the visual presentation, which was almost on the level of a political thriller, spoke to me so powerfully and spoke to the audience, I thought, the same way, that I think it has to come to other cities.
Wow.
It really needs to be seen.
Did it feel timely, Peter?
Totally.
Wow.
Completely, completely. And it was done in a modern vernacular. So you felt as if you were seeing... Yes, and moments, of course, when we're thinking of fascism and the manipulation of crowds, this production just sort of zeroed in on that and knocked it out of the park.
I think that may be the greatest of all political plays.
I agree. It's so good. The rabble. You know, it's just great. Terry, what about you?
Well, the show I've seen since we last got together that excited me most was a New York... Transfer is not right because it was a new production, but it was a new play that originated in a regional theater where I saw it a year or two ago, Chicago's Steppenwolf Theater. It is Tracy Letts's new play, Mary Page Marlowe, which is now being produced off-Broadway in a new production directed by one of our previous guests, Lila Neugebauer, at Second Stage Theater. It's a play in which 10 different woman actors all take turns enacting the life of an ordinary woman, a housewife, at different stages in her life. The scenes are not played in chronological order. It simply unfolds, and it is, for me, I've never heard Letts talking about this, but it strikes me in some ways as being a kind of modern equivalent of Our Town, a play that seeks to establish the validity, the importance, the significance of ordinary everyday experience, its permanent significance. It is a very beautiful production. I didn't much care for the set design, but Lila Neugebauer is, to me, one of the great masters right now of figuring out what to do with a big cast. It unfolds. It sounds in the describing like a kind of avant-garde fracture is how it's being presented. But it unfolds to the eye and ear as a completely coherent story. And it moved me inexpressibly in Chicago, and it had the same effect on me in New York. I think it's one of the... I said when I reviewed it in Chicago, I thought it might be the most purely beautiful play that Letts had written, and I would stand on that now. It's a show that I think people really ought to see, and in another world, it would transfer to Broadway, but it's not going to do that. So see it. It's a very big cast. It's going to be difficult for regional
18 actors.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough show to mount, but it's just lovely and moving, and Lila is... If anybody was in doubt about her significance as a director, forget about it. She is the real right thing.
What did you think of it, Elizabeth?
You know, actually, that's interesting. Before I get to my pick, because I also saw that play, and while I admire it very much, I just did not get into it because I felt like the structure the very structure prevents any emotion from forming. At least for me, I completely stayed on the outside of it. I never got into any of the scenes. This fractured approach is very smart, and he really pulls it off, technically speaking, but it completely prevented me from getting into it. I almost wonder what it would be like to have one person play all of them at the different ages.
I wonder if he would allow frustrated. That as an option.
Yeah, I really don't know, but
I saw it too, and I agree with both of you. I thought it's a beautiful play. I think it is maybe Letts's most beautiful play. I thought that some of the performances weren't as some of the Mary Page Marlowe's were better than other of the Mary Page Marlowe's. They didn't all integrate and coalesce, and maybe that was the point. Maybe those permutations of Mary Page Marlowe are supposed to be that. But sometimes I was moved in a way and then moved away, and I couldn't. It wasn't consistently so that by the end of the evening, it all those fragments came together in this very affecting piece. I could see it in the writing. I could feel it. I couldn't quite get it from the actresses.
Yeah,
Some of them and some of them not. I don't want to say who.
Yeah, very much a play and a production to talk about. And I will, in no invidious comparisons, but I will say that when I saw it in Chicago, Carrie Coon was part of the cast.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get any better than that.
No,
I wish she could have come to New York with it, but we had Blair Brown instead, and she was quite extraordinarily memorable, I thought.
She's a wonderful actress. So, Elizabeth?
Last week, I was at the International Ventriloquist Convention. Yes.
Oh, I love it.
I was at the International Ventriloquist Convention last week for a story that's just come out.
Is this theater for dummies?
I'm sorry. I believe there is a book called Ventriloquism for Dummies.
Oh, okay.
It is, for me, very much part of the theatrical continuum, just like vaudeville or comedy. And it was, a fascinating experience. Two ventriloquists are among the highest paid performers in America right now, Terry Federer and Jeff Dunham. I know, right? These guys are superstars. Not just a ventriloquist. They're like superstars comedians. One is in Vegas, the other one tours and has had lots. I mean, their own styles are not my artistic taste, but they're both virtuoso of the form.
It sounds like a Christopher Guest movie.
It was and wasn't, because what's interesting about something like that convention is the effort that some people and the dedication that some people put into an art form that is pretty much mocked and ridiculed or not taken seriously. But for me, it's a straight line to a kind of age of entertainment that's gone. The age of vaudeville and the age of the theatrical review with, you know, you had like a dog act and a juggler and a ventriloquist and a singer, like often an opera singer. And it's completely fascinating to me. The technical challenges. I'm also obviously a very big fan of the Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis type of comedy act. And a ventriloquist, you know, as I wrote in my piece, is basically a comedy act but done by one person.
When can we read this?
It's out like on Thursday.
Excellent.
15 years ago, a ventriloquist named Jay Johnson
brought
a one-man show to the Atlantic Theater called The Two and Only. And it's one of the best, it's an autobiographical show, a reminiscence of his life and work. And it's one of the best one-man shows of this kind that I've ever seen. I love
it. And he took it to Broadway, and he got a Tony.
Yeah.
Well.
I think Jay Johnson was the last ventriloquist to be on Broadway. I mean, we'll get all the rocktopias of the world, but it's a completely fascinating experience. And I tried to, and I also went to the Ventriloquist Museum, which has got to be one of the most bizarre and fascinating experiences I've ever seen.
I've ever gone through.
I don't know. If anybody's interested in the art form, like ancient art forms and ancient forms of entertainment, it's a it was wild. And I will put in a word, if you go to YouTube and check out Nina Conti, who was absolutely a genius.
A form that is waiting to be revived, brought to life by a radically original performer.
Yeah, it's waiting.
Elizabeth, Terry, it's howdy doody time.
Oh no.
Which means it's time for us to say goodbye. So we're going to wrap things up for now on this episode of Three on the Isle. I'm Peter Marks.
I'm Terry Teachout.
And I'm Elizabeth Vincentelli. You've been listening to Three on the Isle, a podcast from New York about theater in America, hosted by American Theater Magazine.
Our producer is the redoubtable Kirby Pate.
Nice.
You can follow us on Twitter at Three on the Isle and write to us at threeontheisle@gmail.com. Spell it out, please.
And please leave us a rating, a good one, and a review, an excellent one, on iTunes or Google Play.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Isle, or the Mezzanine, or the balcony, or...